Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Linguist John McWhorter has a keen ear for language and is a close reader of literature and listener to the way we speak now. He delights in the way words are used and how their meanings change over time, how they morph and twist and adapt. If I say, like, literally, and you cringe, he's got thoughts on that. This hour on Point, John McWhorter on words and grammar and the fluidity of meaning. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the very meaning of words change? Do you celebrate it, resist it, lead it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is linguist John McWhorter, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, the author of The Power of Babel, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Language of Hoax. His new book is Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, Like Literally. Part of the title right there. John McWhorter, welcome back to On Point. It's always great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You say right off the bat that one of the hardest notions for a human being to shake is that a language is something that is, when language actually is something always becoming. Explain that.
Yeah, and I would even narrow it down. A word is not something that is. It's a process. And yet it's hard to see that in the same way as it's hard to believe that mountains are wearing down. It's slow, but it's inevitable. And what it means is that language is something that always changes. It's not that it might change. It's that it will. And it's not that it'll change in that we'll have new words for new things and new words coming in from other languages. Even the boring, vanilla part of language is always morphing into something else, just like that clump of stuff in a lava lamp. And yet we're trained. It's completely understandable how we often feel about it. We're trained to hear the changes as mistakes. And there's this thing called a dictionary that gives the illusion that a language can be something that sits still and that there's an inherently right way and then a wrong way. In this book, what I'm trying to do is get across to readers how linguists see these things and to show that it's not about politics. It's not about being a hang loose kind of person. Mm-hmm. It's that languages, and I'm not going to say dynamic because that word is worn out and yeah. It sounds like I've got some kind of agenda. Language is inherently motile. It can't not change. So we need to learn to just enjoy it.
What do you mean it can't change? It can't not change. You know, as you say, dictionary's right there. Open it up. Find your word, and there's a definition right there.
Yeah, that somebody put there at one point in time. A dictionary is like a Polaroid snapshot, and we don't look at how somebody looked in a Polaroid in 1978 and say, that is the way they are, when you know lots of time has gone by and they and everybody else knows that that's not the way they are or ever were. It was just the way they happened to be that day. No language has ever not changed. And the fact that a language is written and that an awful lot of people speak it and that it's today rather than yesterday doesn't change that one bit.
I mean, we know this. Anybody who's read any literature of any age knows it because, I mean, take Shakespeare, take Melville, you name it. The language mm-hmm. they use is not the language we use. So we know things change over time. And yet when we feel the process of that change, when it's put right in our face or in our ear, many people bridle at it.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good while it's happening. An example that I sometimes use is that you know that your siblings are going to start dating and what dating entails, but you don't really want to hear that much about it when it's actually happening. You kind of turn your head. But it has to happen, and we end up with this feeling that, well, the process from Beowulf to Chaucer was majestic, and the process from Chaucer to Shakespeare, well, that's so interesting. The language changes with the times. But then, for some reason, reason, around about 1800, the language is supposed to have stopped changing. I think people think that modernity, part of modernity, is that the language sits still. I get where that notion comes from. In my gut, there's a part of me that would expect that, but it just isn't true, and we know it because, frankly, we don't understand even Shakespeare as well as we're often told, and it's just because there is an inevitable process of morphing. Note, I don't say evolution.
Yep.
Not about something getting better and definitely not worse, just morphing. That's what language does.
You throw out modernity as an explanation for that, but reading your book, there's also something about how we began to develop the beginnings of a middle class for the first time, the bourgeoisie, and a certain way of speaking became a marker of having arrived in that strata.
Mm-hmm. And that is the beginning of the sense that there's a right way and a wrong way. It's surprising reading comments about English earlier than that and seeing how much lower a flame that way of looking at the way you speak English was. That starts with a class consciousness. And what it does mean is that none of us intend it, and I am certainly not completely immune from it myself. But the idea that that person's saying it wrong and I'm saying it right gives vent to that human tendency to wish to feel superior in one way or another. And I honestly believe that it's something that we could learn to check in ourselves, although we'll never be completely rid of it. I certainly won't be. As much as we check ourselves for racism and sexism and classism and various other isms. Prescriptivism, I think, comes from that same well, even though we are explicitly taught it, which makes it hard to wrap our minds around that being what it is.
I mean, it's funny, Samuel Johnson, who, of course, started assembling, as you remind us, what would become the first true dictionary of the English language. But even he writes, and you quote him here, you say it's kind of absurd about the absurdity of thinking the definitions there would not change. He says, "We laugh at the elixir that promises to prolong life to 1,000 years. And with equal justice, may the lexicographer be derided who," and he says, "shall imagine that his dictionary can embalm his language and secure it from corruption and decay."
Now, he says corruption and decay.
Still, not exactly applause for the change.
Leads to that idea that there's something wrong with it. But I think a lot of people read Johnson and think, the hearty old gentleman, he told it like it was. But then somehow, when it comes to today, we think that, for example, literally is supposed to always have the same meaning. Or that a word, and I'm not sure Samuel Johnson was completely clear on this, that if a word changes, then the change can, in some scientific sense, be deemed as wrong, when really it comes down to something very simple. If everybody understands it, if it doesn't impede understanding, then upon what basis could anybody say that it was wrong? Clarity rules. And this is the hard part. That takes care of itself. It's not as if there need to be people standing on the sidelines determining what makes sense. Language takes care of itself that way. It's a communal process, and things that don't make sense don't end up becoming general. And so these things end up coming in that are new, and that makes sense. They don't interfere with clarity. And yet we're taught to think of them as putrid in some way. And all of it, frankly, none of it makes any logical sense. And the only way I think that we can be aware of it is to be ushered into a new way of seeing and hearing language, seeing it on the page and hearing it spoken. And I think linguists end up being aware of this sort of thing, and we often tend to keep it to ourselves. And I think that we need to start spreading the word more, because it makes language so much more fun. Just walking down the street becomes like going to the zoo, as opposed to listening to language as you walk down the street and thinking, goodness, it's all falling apart. That's no fun. Life is hard enough.
Well, I mean, that I get that, and the part of me that wants to be fluid and cool wants to just roll with that. And then at the same time, you know, you brought up literally, and, you know, people just, you know, it can make your head explode when it's not used. It literally has a meaning. We'd like to think something that actually is. And then when it gets used to be something quite figurative, that's not literal at all. You know, I don't know. I literally, you know, my head literally blew off. Well, no, it didn't.
Yeah.
Here we are talking and your head's on your shoulders. And suddenly I don't feel like such a hipster anymore, maybe. Or
It doesn't mean what it used to, because words' meanings are always changing. So there was a time when literally meant by the letter. And you would have known that over time it was going to change to mean something like really. It was going to emphasize. Nowadays, people use it to mean essentially really when trying to highlight some figurative expression to say that, yes, this is really what I was feeling. And so it's cute in a way because literally can be used in its original meaning and then it can be used as what is exactly its opposite and people tear their hair out about it. But one, have you ever not known what anybody meant? I mean, you can athletically decide that you don't.
Yeah, but no, of course I knew.
But you do. And second, there are plenty of words like that in the language that don't bother us at all. And so you run fast, then you can sit fast, at which point you obviously are not doing anything rapidly. You seed a watermelon. Does that mean that you take some seeds and put them in? No. You seed the ground. Well, then you're putting the seeds into the ground. Long list of these things. They have a name. They're called contronyms. The fact that they have a name is less important than that they don't bother us at all. And if anything, with all of the ones but literally, you think, oh, that's cool. It kind of makes you proud that you command this particular language particular wrinkles. But then with literally, all of a sudden, people have these T-shirts about it. I hate to say that. It's arbitrary, and we need to just get over it and enjoy that there's a word that can mean both things, but we always know which meaning is intended.
I guess I fully know that it's arbitrary. Some of these things may bother me, and some just don't. You know, lately people don't so often say drive safely anymore. More and more I hear people just say drive safe.
Yeah.
I know exactly what they mean. It's an easy way of saying it. You'd leave that sort of pompous Lee off the end, and yet I've seen, you know, grammar police just, again, tearing their hair out.
And, you know, there are plenty of languages where there would be no equivalent to the Lee and nobody would have any problem. And frankly, English has always been one of them. Often, Lee is optional. Now, there's an extent to which we hear things as corresponding to levels of the social. And we can't help that because we're human beings. And you might think drive safe sounds a little bit sweat sock compared to drive safely. And you feel like you're an educated person. And one might have that feeling. One might even think to oneself, you're not going to say drive safe in a formal setting. Although, you know, how many formal settings do most Americans spend much time in anyway, especially since the 1960s?
True.
But it's not that drive safe is wrong in some way, because it's quite clear English has always had adverbs of those kinds. That's the language that we speak, always mutable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about language and how it changes, how usage morphs and moves and upsets us when it does sometimes, but also lets language adapt and change in important ways, like literally. My guest John McWhorter says today his new book is Words on the Move: Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. Excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from New York, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. You can join us. Are you ready for his view that language is about change, about becoming? Are you in the language police camp, or do you celebrate the fluidity of language? And what changing language is driving you crazy lately? What new usage do you love? Does it change over time? You better believe it does. Here's a little bit from Macbeth. Ian McKellen plays Macbeth talking about his plans to kill King Duncan, to take over as king. Shakespeare.
Besides, this Duncan hath borne his faculties so meek, hath been so clear in his great office, that his virtues will plead like angels, trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off.
Okay, John McWhorter, yeah, Shakespeare doesn't write like we talk. Did he sound ordinary in his day? Was his language fancy in his day? Or is it just the centuries that makes it sound, that make it sound, you know, distant?
Well, Shakespeare was not writing in the vernacular by any means. But we listen to words and something like that, and we think, well, it's English. We recognize all of the words. None of the words are obsolete. And so we think to ourselves, we're often told that, well, it's poetic. Well, you get it across better when you happen to have a British accent. Mm. Well, you have to reach up, that it's high language. But part of it, what makes language like that sound sometimes like a radio station that isn't quite tuned in, is simply because the word's meanings have changed in ways that don't mean that it sounds like it's Hebrew, but that mean that we can't capture what Shakespeare meant as gracefully as we would appreciate. And it's not about poetry, and it's not about height. It's just about the fact that words are always ooching along. And so, for example, his taking off,
Mm-hmm. The deep damnation of his taking off. I don't know.
It sounds like English, but take off what? No, it's what we would say take out. It's his killing. Now, you might look that kind of thing up.
Tony Soprano on line two.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Or, you know, born his authorities. You know, what are the authorities, his faculties? The meanings of those words have changed slightly. And it's interesting. There's a guy named Conrad Spoke who has written an adaptation of Macbeth. I don't want to say translation because then people think that I mean slang. Just an adaptation where each one of those terms and words where you can't get it today spoken in real time. I don't mean if you're reading it, but spoken in real time. Mm-hmm. If you can't get it today, he replaces that word with something that scans the same way. And it only changes under 10% of the text. But it means that is it exactly Shakespeare? No. But it's Shakespeare, which you can hear live and actually take in without having extra coffee, without getting
tired. Sort of like revised versions of the Bible.
Yeah, which nobody has any problem with. I think Shakespeare would approve. And yet I know whenever I talk about this, there are people who tell me that I have no business being a professor, that it's a matter of reaching upward or having a British accent. It's not. It actually demonstrates what I'm talking about with language change, which is that no matter how we would like it to be otherwise, words, meanings are always becoming something different.
Words, usage, language, like clouds, John McWhorter says, always changing, but it can drive us crazy too. Betsy from the Virgin Islands, the island of St. Thomas. Ah, wonderful. Betsy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, you're on, Betsy.
Hi, I'm here in St. Thomas. It's a beautiful day in St. Thomas. My pet peeve is people that, and I've heard them on your station saying, me and my friends are going to do such and such.
Oh, how dreadful. Do you have to race down to the beach and plunge your head into the waters of the Caribbean?
Yes. I mean, we grew up learning English. What are they teaching children today? And it's perfectly, supposedly intelligent people are using this and say, my friends and I. Is me more important than who you're with? Is it the generation?
Yeah, let us pick it up, Betsy. I mean, John, I don't know. I did spend some number of hours, you know, raising my own children, saying I would go to the beach. My friends and I would go to the beach. You know, it's not me in that combination. But you write about it and say, well, what do you say to Betsy's complaint?
Well, okay, my take on that is not. That is a very important construction. It's not that I'm somebody who doesn't make up his bed. It's not that I'm somebody who isn't generally called a rather anal, starchy person. It's not that we just need to hang loose. Mm-hmm. A convention has arisen to think that we're supposed to use I in that kind of construction. And that has become so settled, that particular construction has become so settled that one must, as a speaker of English, if you want to have any influence in society, adhere to saying my friend and I, or I and my friend, although that really doesn't sound very graceful, because of the idea that you're supposed to use the subject form when something is a subject. So you have to teach your kids that. I'm already thinking about when I'm going to introduce my 4-year-old to that. But this is the point. No child grows up naturally saying, my friend and I. Any child, no matter what you expose them to, first says, my friend and me. And that's because, and I'm saying this with full respect for what we've all been taught. Mm-hmm. I certainly have learned to say my friend and I when I know people are listening who might be critical. Mm-hmm. The rule is nonsense. It's something that was made up by one person about 200 years ago, a little bit less, and it happened to develop a certain kind of influence for rather random reasons. But for example, in French, you say my friend and me, and nobody raises an eyebrow. That's the way English grammar works, meaning that if somebody says my friend and me went to the store, it's not bad. It's not an error. It's just casual. And in this case, it's natural. It's the way English actually happened. The idea that we're supposed to say my friend and I is based on one person who decided that English should be more like Latin. Well, you know, she's dead, so is Latin, and here we are stuck with it.
So it's less about, to your mind, following rules than preparing people to be accepted socially. I mean, you say no linguist denies the reality, which is that these rules, having been entrenched in society as measures of formality and social worth, must be followed in formal contexts and taught to young people. It's inevitable for humans to rank, to create hierarchies of estimation often on the basis of differences unparsable by logic. So whether or not the rule makes sense, there's a social reason for conforming.
Yeah, and we can't pretend that that is not true. But we have to realize that we are attending conventions that are as arbitrary as, you know, what kind of collar, you know, how long your skirt is.
Yeah.
We can't judge people on the basis of that.
Well, or maybe some will inevitably, but don't be too self-righteous about it. Joan in Hartsville, South Carolina. Joan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I guess I fall in the language police category.
Okay.
Being fairly well-educated.
Are you whacking your nightstick into your hand here?
I have my biggest pet peeve that I hear is just a word being constantly used incorrectly, and that is the word livid. I read it in books by well-known authors, and everybody uses it wrong.
What's the misuse you think you're hearing, Joan? What's the misuse?
Pardon?
What's the misuse you think you hear?
Yeah, this one is new on me. What's the misuse?
Yeah.
I hear the word livid being used, meaning person is getting angry and red in the face and ready to punch something out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Isn't that what it means, Joan? What does it mean? You've caught me out. What does it mean?
If you look it up in the dictionary, it means the exact opposite. It means you're going into shock and the blood is going to your liver. And that's where the word comes from, and it means it's complete opposite of getting angry and red in the face.
Geez, Joan, I don't know how old how old your dictionary is. I mean, I just don't know. But John McWhorter, growing up, I have to say, to me, that means angry and red in the face.
Yeah, Joan, to be honest, you know, nobody has looked up every word in the dictionary, and I've never examined the history of livid. But if that was the original meaning, the simple fact is that the meaning, along the lines of what we've been talking about on this show in particular, the meaning has changed to the point that I think we can say that a critical mass of people, and in this case, highly critical mass of people, think that livid does mean angry with the blood rising to your face. And when it gets to that point, and once again, there's no issue of clarity, everybody thinks it means a certain thing, then it does. And an example that wouldn't bother us is that, for example, not too long ago, obnoxious meant subject to harm. That was the original meaning.
Subject
and if you go into older usage books, people will complain that it's gradually coming to mean essentially noxious. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, it changed. And here we are. And I don't think we mind that because we weren't alive to be annoyed by it. I'm afraid livid would have to be the same thing.
Joan, we're gonna have to live with livid a little bit there. I love some of the history you give us here. Words like very simple words like darn and the way they evolved in a way that may have been, I don't know, upsetting to people at the time. But darn, can you trace it? It goes back to eternal damnation, and there's a mid stop in there that we all know from kind of old West movies. Give us that line of descent.
Right. Eternal damnation, and that gradually becomes tarnation, especially if tarnation changes in terms of sound change, which also is inevitable, into tarnation.
Like, and so off you the frontier somehow. We picture a guy with a whiskey bottle and a
tarnation. Right. And pretty soon you have darnation and then darn. So darn really is, quote unquote, not a real word. There is no old English word for darn that's something like darnuch or something like that.
Okay.
It's an accident. And now here we are.
And then you get an old meaning, an old way of saying spiritual, which has a very different sound today.
Do you mean silly?
No, I was going with your word? With your ghastly, ghostly line of descent. That today ghastly meant spiritual and now becomes ghostly.
Oh, of course, yes, because ghastly had the root for ghost in it. And so what it meant was ghostly. But the sound has changed so that we don't spontaneously associate it with ghost. And you can imagine how something which is spiritual and therefore reminding you of a ghost might evolve to indicate the frightened feeling that you might have towards a ghost. And especially once ghosts might have less of a presence in most people's minds, then ghastly ends up meaning something that just evokes fear and you don't really think about Casper at all. And we think of something like ghastly as a cute example. Oh, it's funny how that sort of thing happens to some words. The point with words on the move is that the words where that kind of thing doesn't happen are the exception. Essentially, all words are always doing that kind of thing.
Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Summer. Summer, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I love the show, and this is a really fascinating topic. I've been sitting here nodding to most of what your guest has been saying, and one of my comments is regarding idioms or terms that seem to pop up pretty fast into the regular usage. One I was most recently noting was throwing shade, which means to criticize, broadly criticize, kind of in a derogatory sense. And that was recently used on an NPR segment to describe the political dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, and I'm in my late 30s, and for me, that was a startling usage in that platform. I thought, oh my goodness, NPR is using throwing shade to describe the political atmosphere. I wouldn't have expected that. It was a newer phrase to me. But I wonder if your guest can comment on the correlation between age and the discounting of new terms or new usage of words. Because to me, it seems like a lot of the changes are coming from youth culture.
Yes.
And that might be tied to older folks, and I put myself in that category, thinking, well, hey, we know how things should be used, or we know what terms are legitimate. And the young people are coming and changing it right from underneath us.
And the way age relates to discounting or adopting or originating, for that matter, as you say, Summer, throwing shade and all of its kin, John. I mean, I find it quite delightful when they make that leap and finally show up on NPR. But Summer's right. This comes from the realm of youth very often.
Yeah, this is the hardest thing because, yes, change tends to come not only from quote-unquote below in terms of class, but also from younger people. And that means that we hear the changes and we think of them as these slangy things that people who are chewing gum and aren't fully mature yet say. And we assume, well, they're going to drop that and then they're going to start speaking in a more mature fashion as we do. And that's true of some things. You know, linguists work hard to tease apart that which people just do when they're 17, as opposed to that which they're going to keep doing when they're 77. This is the thing that you have to wrap your head around, which is that the way that Latin became French was that same process. It wasn't ancient people in Gaul who were being linguistically creative and tossing new things in, to a small extent, but it was the younger people, because younger people are coming into the language. They have a more flexible attitude towards it. If there's social change, there might be more things that they have to come up with different ways to express. And so we hear young people and we think, oh, that's just slang. But it's exactly that kind of thing that changed old English into modern English. It's weird, but it becomes wonderful if you really understand that those teenagers walking down the street are speaking to a large extent the future. It's not just that they're being immature.
Well, it can be very surprising. I find I very often just delight in it. It's the sound of a younger generation making its claim on the language, to my mind. I mean, there is a part, there's some thread of happy rebellion in having their own phrases, one's own phrases when you're young, to describe things in a way that your parents don't use.
Tom, some. And I could leave it there, but okay. I want to push it a little bit further because most of it is subconscious. And so, for example, if you listen, it's at the point where we can hear recordings. Listen to teenagers, kind of Brady Bunch teenagers talking in the early 70s. They sound like teenagers. They've got gum in their mouth. Mm-hmm. Not a whole lot of like, because that hadn't come in yet. They don't sound proper, but they don't use a whole lot of like because that hadn't happened. Listen to a teenager now. They're doing the likes. They have no conscious control over it. They're not doing it on purpose. But those likes have settled in, and a lot of us who think of like as something that people use when they're 22 don't realize that it's at the point where you can be 50 and you're using like, frankly, almost as much as they do. I regularly see people sitting on park benches with already graying hair using like as much as any teenager because the language has changed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about language and how it changes, how usage morphs and moves and upsets us sometimes when it does, but also lets language adapt and change. John McWhorter is with us, linguist, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, author of the new book, Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. The way we speak, the way we use the language, the way we say words changes over time. 1934 film, The Thin Man, Detective Nick Charles, played by William Powell, hoping to gather suspects for a crime. Here he talks with his wife, Nora, played by Myrna Loy. Notice how he says the word suspects.
I'm going to give a party and invite all the suspects.
The suspects? Well, they won't come.
No, yes, they will.
Suspects. They won't come. The suspects. What is that about? Here's Mary Tyler Moore, 1972. Friends in a stairwell talk about ordering Chinese food.
Well, come on up with us and we'll all have Chinese food.
Yeah. Why are you so excited about Chinese food?
Well, you never had it before.
Oh. Can you believe this? A man who has never had Chinese food in his whole life?
Well, I don't know. Maybe a little intonation there that we don't use anymore. John McWhorter, suspects. Suspects? Were they mispronouncing the word in the movie in 1934?
No, it's just that when a verb becomes a noun, something we don't think about, it's part of what makes the language wonderful. This is the grammar we should be paying attention to, not, you know, Billy and me went to the store. It's that you say suspect if it's a verb. I suspect you of something. A suspect is somebody who you suspect, just like you outlaw something that an outlaw does. You rebel against a rebel. You record a record. That's part of speaking the English language. Mm-hmm. And if something becomes just a thing, familiar, then you have that same movement of the accent backwards. And so Chinese food in 1972, when it was still novel to have Chinese food, we say Chinese food because the accent moved back just like it did to create suspect. A suspect is a thing. Chinese food is a thing rather than Chinese food, mm-hmm. Martian mm-hmm. food. Mm-hmm. That's how language changes. And these are wonderful things. And instead, I worry that people are walking around angry that people are using impact as a verb, etc., when there are these neat things that you can hear going on right around you all the time that are wonderful.
Well, be the change. Thomas in Berthoud, Colorado. You're on with John McWhorter. Thank you for calling, Thomas.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be on your show.
Good to have you. What are you hearing, Thomas?
So someone that recently I started noticing is that people will talk about something like about a huge blizzard that hit them, and the person they talk to would say, yeah, no. And to me, it always seemed as if they were agreeing and then disagreeing. And it would literally cause my head to explode.
Yeah, no. It's a beautiful example of language change and how words create, what words end up morphing into different meanings. The no is something that signals that you are disagreeing with a point that both you and the person you're talking to know is in the air, that people often make. A whole lot of the things that we say are a response to implied statements that you don't need to state. Mm-hmm. Totally is the same thing. She's totally going to come. What that means is not she's going to come in actuality or she's really going to come. She's totally going to come means some people say that she's not going to come, but you and I know
yes.
that she's going to come. Nobody teaches us
There's
that.
A shared
yeah,
understanding.
No, it's the same thing. So yeah, no is yeah, no to that which other people are saying because you and I both know that yeah, yeah. So you know.
Yeah, no.
That struck me at first, too, though, about 15 years ago.
It is
but
really
it really has become entrenched.
Well, you're generous in listening and understanding that there's this shared understanding that's being acknowledged with what sounds peculiar you extend that to when people throw "and stuff" at the end of a sentence, saying it's not just a kind of a frivolous tack on, but it's probably there's a community that does have a shared understanding of some other realm. What about "and stuff"? And it's not new, you tell us as well.
Oh, no. "And stuff" goes all the way back to Middle English. You can see people using it and you think, wow, they were real people. And of course, we're saying "and stuff" here, but I think our listeners understand that there is a different expression used. It's "and something else," which is probably used even more. Mm-hmm. And you listen to especially the other one and you think, oh, dear, profanity. And we think of "and stuff" as just raggedy. But it's another one of those things that flags that which we know but we're not talking about. And so if you say with "trash and stuff," you mean that it's not just garbage, but the things that often go along with garbage, such as the smell or a broken window or something else of that nature. And so even something like "and stuff" or the more vulgar version, our grammar, it's a kind of grammar that we're not taught. And another thing that I actually
acknowledging
that
we'll both understand what I'm talking about here. I'm evoking a realm of shared understanding.
Precisely. And that is grammar to a linguist as much as putting ED on the end of something and making it past. The public never hears about that part of grammar. It's called pragmatics, which is a lousy name for it, which is part of why I think linguists don't write about it. But Words on the Move, without getting too much into the jargon, explains the grammar that they don't want you to know about because it makes you hear language with a kind of delight rather than a kind of ashtray disgust.
Well, that helps to understand that there's some other hidden principle here because we've got listeners, writing in saying, wait a minute, this guy's a linguist? Aren't linguists supposed to be like the guardians of language, the rules as we know them?
No, that's not what linguists do. Linguists study what's often called the science of language. And one way of putting it is that the linguist, I'm assuming we can say H-E-L-L, I'm going to not assume it.
Yes, all right.
You can? Okay.
Yes.
We don't listen and think, what the hell? We listen and think, why the hell? So if somebody says sandwich instead of sandwich, it's not what the hell is sandwich? Mm. It's why would the sounds come out that way? And there's always an elegant reason. So linguist is not grammarian or grammar scold. That's not anybody that has a doctorate and teaches at a university. Linguists are people who describe how people actually speak. And it's a really interesting subject, to tell you the truth. If our job were to teach people about Billy and me went to the store, we'd have about 13 things to teach. There's a very compact set of rules like those. Linguistics is luckily much larger than that.
Kyle writes to us, as a PhD in linguistics, much of each semester is showing future teachers how language is changing right now. Abdul in Duluth, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Abdul. You're on the air with John McWhorter.
Hi, Tom. This is fun stuff. I am loving this conversation. As a native French speaker, this is really fun for me. I learn English, and the way the French is and English, just the way we form phrases and everything else is really different. And what your guest said about my friend and I and my friend and me in French is my friend and me. So I've always been interested in language. And the one thing that I want to ask is now kids use, I'm 31, so I consider myself a big kid, I guess.
Okay.
So kids use the word sick a lot to describe something good. So, wow, this is sick. I mean, I don't use that because my dad will kill me. But, I just wanted to know what your guest thought about that. And then at the end of the day, I totally agree with him that clarity wins. As long as you and I both understand what we're talking about, what's the debate about? I mean, you know, if you know what I mean and I know what you mean, then we're both on the same page. Clarity wins.
Abdul, thank you so much for your call from Georgia. Sick to mean awesome, wonderful, really fine.
Yeah, I find that one very charming because it's ordinary. I mean, I think most of us most immediately will think of the now slightly elderly Black English usage of bad to mean good. But then, you know, wicked and fierce, it's common to have these supposedly negative words refer to the positive, partly because of the sense that that which goes against the rules or that which is fascinatingly negative is therefore good in being stimulating. Mm-hmm. But those things happen all the time. And there might even be a certain element of deliberate creativity in the fact that terms like what the current sick seem to always renew themselves. But everybody knows what it means. My students now say sick all the time, and not once have I thought, oh goodness, is that person referring to an intestinal ailment? I know just what they mean, and despite the fact that I'm not one of them, I'm not sitting around doing things with them. And so it just means that this is how language works. From Beowulf to Breaking Bad is things like sick.
What about the word like? We've got a listener here, Skander, writes to us, I was once smitten with a beautiful young woman who seemed inclined toward me in a similar way. But after she used the word like 5 times in a 10-word sentence, I could no longer take her seriously. It has proliferated, and in fairly short order, you described to us. What is that about? How do you explain it?
What the hell? But it's why the hell. Like is gorgeous. Now, I should say, it is used an awful lot, and anybody who wants to be taken seriously needs to learn to spray their speech for those likes if they're trying to be convincing, if they're making a formal speech, if they're contributing something to a class and wish to actually be heard, and maybe even on early dates, but not later ones, because in casual speech, those likes actually are very subtle. There are dissertations, there are linguistics papers written about the intricacies of like.
But what's the genesis? Why the proliferation in the last 2 or 3 decades? Is there something? Are we holding our language more loosely? Have we lost confidence in the precise meaning of words, so we want to condition every word? Nothing quite describes reality as we understand it, so like puts a fuzz around it. What is it?
Well, sometimes actually like is emphasizing rather than putting fuzz. But you know what it is, Tom, actually? You could do a whole book about like, maybe, just maybe, if I feel like it, I might do one one day. Like is polite. There's an extent to which when people say like, and this is only one of the 3.5 usages of like that you can catalog, what they really mean is I don't want to push my point too hard because I'm acknowledging that you may have other valid opinions. I've written about that in a piece in the Times, and I really meant it. Now, once again, too much like cannot help but sound tentative because we all have that original meaning of like, meaning similar to, in our heads. We can't change that. But in casual speech, it is actually as grammatically rich as any number of little words like that in any other languages where we would not condemn people speaking those other languages for using them. It's just that it's new and it seems young. Although I say again, it's at the point where middle-aged people use it quite a bit too.
Like as a generous grace note. I have to meditate on that. Tace in Austell, Georgia. Tace, you're on with John McWhorter. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point. I'm in the ranks of the grammar police, and I feel that if you change a word changes over time, that's fine. There are many reasons that a word can change, functional shifts or combining words. It's going to happen. It's inevitable. But when you start changing the rules, now I say we have a problem. And I can give 2 examples that won't take up all your time.
Yep.
Drive safe. I drive a bus. I tell people to drive safely. Now, if you think it's okay to just speak informally, because when do we really speak formally, you might talk to me with my kids, and then they're going to pick up what you're saying. But they're teaching something else in school. Yeah. And while we don't have an Academy of English the way they have the Academia Royal Española, we do have academia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they're going to teach them, and now you're going to confuse them. Or if somebody's learning another language, you might confuse them because they're trying to learn the language. And how are you really enriching the language by trying to take this snapshot of the language today, by preserving the rules, by allowing you to say, well, me and my friends are going to...
Yeah. I hear you loud and clear, Tace. It's funny. I'm going to take it to John McWhorter. I find myself, even if I'm speaking to my children now, and I want to say drive safely, it sounds a little formal. And I mean it with such love that I want to say drive safe because it sounds a little more intimate. And I know it's not grammatical, and yet I myself occasionally use it. But John McWhorter, you hear Tace saying, hey, pretty soon you've got no rules and it's just a ball of confusion out there. How are you supposed to teach anybody anything? Or how's a foreigner supposed to learn English when we don't even stand up for the, you know, some rules ourselves?
This is a whole other thing. Tace is making perfect sense. But there is, and Tace, with all due respect, but there's a misconception that an American easily falls into, which is that if somebody is listening to both the informal and the formal varieties at the same time, they're going to get confused. But I think most of us know. It's often said that people don't know this, but I get the feeling that America's getting wiser about this. If you grow up with English and Spanish, you're not going to be confused. You're just going to grow up speaking two languages. Kids do it all the time. Yep. They can learn many languages. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with varieties of a single language. And so to say drive safe doesn't mean that you're putting somebody in danger of being impenetrable to drive safely as they get older. To speak a language is to speak different levels of it, and we take in the different levels at the same time. And so that's the real answer to that, that human beings tend to be, frankly, around the world, bilingual, although to an American mm-hmm. being bilingual mm-hmm. seems exotic, but certainly bi-dialectal. And so you learn both. I want my children to hear the informal range, and they're going to hear the formal range too, because my wife and I alternate between the two, and they see and hear the two of them all the time.
It must make
the
it hard for teachers
more plastic
in school.
Than we think.
But for teachers in school, if your kids are learning a different language at home, a very informal language, and in school they're trying to assert something that then just sounds exotic or unused. I mean, I grew up in a house, I guess, where it was fairly formal language used. So there was no friction in learning that at school. If it had been
people like you and me are lucky. Yeah. And I mean, there's a where do you draw the line? If people are going to school and it's basically a whole different language, even if not called it, mm-hmm. then there need to be special pedagogical techniques to help kids make the transition. But if we're talking about the difference between Billy and me went to the store at dinner and Billy and I went to the store as something that you're going to put in your composition book, kids can make the jump.
So as a linguist, you're not condemning them to second-class status by saying that's okay?
In that sense? No, because they're going to learn both. They're going to be fine. Now, if we're talking about them learning Amharic at home and then English in school, of course, we need to have a bridge. But bi-dialectalism is natural, and most kids aren't even aware of these differences until they get older and they're told that it's something exotic.
Language is the very nature of language to be like clouds, John McWhorter writes in his new book. It's Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still, like literally. John McWhorter, it is always a complete delight to talk with you, and I thank you for being with us today.
This is one of my favorite shows, Tom. Thank you very much.
John McWhorter, professor of English, comparative literature at Columbia University. Words on the Move is his book. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Enjoy your language usage out there, however you roll. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.